Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. I'm your host, Murdoch Gaddy, and in today's rockcast, we have Melissa Hosgood, the Managing Director and Portfolio Manager and Founder at Labasa Capital. Labasa Capital is an Australian real estate credit fund. They have a target return of 9%, annualized real return of 12.46%, with a 0.5% management fee, no performance fee. Why I got Melissa on is they do a very, very interesting thing. Like, we've had a number of great guests on in the property space that do the credit side. Some do the equity side, but what Labasa does is they have the ability to fund the entire life cycle of a project. Some of the other fund managers do as well, but what I find that's interesting is they're doing it at a boutique level, and the subcategories of the properties, a number of the property asset classes that I really, really like, in particular, land subdivision, with, you know, growing Australia, farmland, converting it, is a great space. The other space which I have been eager to get involved with and have gotten involved with since COVID has been the rise of distribution centers. And one thing Melissa discusses is I thought distribution centers, you know, you get one for Port of Newcastle, New South Wales, Queensland, Perth, and then they're done. But what I'm hearing is a number of these companies are requiring more than one distribution hub for, you know, if a sickness breaks out, they can still function. But the other thing Melissa said, that the culture of the delivery business is changing from being, you know, something arriving, you know, in a day to apparently China's doing it, you know, within 2 hours. So if that's the path that Australia is going, having both, you know, a state and then a municipality when they can do jobs within half an hour, I find very, very interesting. And the other space as well is the rise and the growth of the work anywhere strategy, which has been made really, really easy and more accessible via these light industrial warehouses or business parks with a roller door. You know, you can park your boat downstairs in the gym, operate whatever business you want, anything from my business to a dropshipping company, a Pokemon store, I don't know, like, you know, a wood, you know, making surfboards. In the middle of nowhere, you can move to Queensland, you can move to, you know, the back of Bourke, and then run these businesses, which I think is, you know, quite interesting as well. Join us as Melissa unpacks the credit fund. She also does direct projects, having wealthy families and wealthy investors, you know, participating alongside in some of these projects. And, you know, hear Melissa discuss, you know, how they look at a project, some of the deals, and then, you know, what happens from a risk component if a deal goes sideways and how they work with that particular investor or client or developer to get a positive outcome. So before we get into this podcast, please remember this podcast is intended for entertainment purposes only and should not be taken as any form of financial advice. Be sure to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the podcast and keep your feedback coming. You can reach me at mgatty@ywm.com.au. So with that being said, I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Melissa Hosgood, welcome to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management.
Good morning, Murdoch. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on, Melissa. Why don't we begin things off and telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the world of finance.
Thanks for that. Now, I originally came from China. I go back a little bit more about myself. I've been here in Australia for 20 years now. Australia's home. I came here to do my English study initially back in 2004. Did my 4 months English study and fell in love with the country. Came from Shanghai, a very buzzy city. very busy. Since I came here, what stood out to me is the people factor, letting alone the environment is just so beautiful. There's a lot of individual attention, and there's a lot of warmth between, from the human interaction, I felt. Hence, I stayed. I continued on with my master's study with the University of Technology, Sydney. Had a great fun for 2 years and learned heaps. Luckily, straight after that, I got into a role into the banking world. And fast forward, that journey ended up to be 11 and a half years in banking, of which 6.5 years with HSBC head office here in Sydney, followed by about 4 to 5 years with Westpac head office in Brisbane. In the banking days, I look after a bank's largest clientele portfolio. I look after a portfolio of financial institutions groups as the relationship management team. This cross covers one of some of those most prominent financial institutions in the world. Customers are such as all the investment banks, Goldman Sachs, and global top 40 to 50 fund managers and asset managers and insurance groups. So I learned, throw myself into deep end and learn heaps. Now, after 11 and a half years, I start thinking, what I do next. I've learned this much. It is also at the same time, whilst I'm still working a very high, fast-paced banking role, I start to take an interest on, I'm so devoted and busy working 9 to 5 and 9 to 10, actually. If I were to choose to invest my own banking salary, which I have very little time to look after whilst looking after big customers, what I'm going to invest comfortably in terms of risk and return. Now, this is when real estate start to come into my radar. Looked at, again, naturally as a banker, as a risk manager, doing deals in the banks. And when I looked at the market, the cycle, where Australia is at in property, real estate, historical data, and how real estate as asset class behave, I just fell in love into it. So start investing real estate, then which eventuated to 2019. To start and funded La Baza Capital as a real estate focused investment manager. The rest is history.
La Baza. I was trying to figure it out. What is La Baza? Why the name La Baza?
Good question.
I love a good origin story.
Many people
Why
ask.
La Baza?
Yes. We get this question a lot. People want to know what's the story behind it as a boutique house, of course. And I'm glad the name means something. So La Baza, being a real estate focused investment management house, we named ourselves after a historical building. So La Baza House is a heritage building in North Caulfield, Melbourne. And it's a building with beautiful architecture design for that era, and it's still beautiful. It's also known for another name for the house is House of Elite, House of Dreams. It has beautiful stony structures, so the structure is very solid. Now the La Baza logo, the arch window, it's taken from the inspiration of the La Baza House. Again, it's a stone, sandstone structure, grounded, level-headed, which represents our approach and our thinking as the investment manager, the money manager for our investors. We are not emotion-driven. We're data-driven. We make sound and grounded, conservative decisions for our investment. At the same time, it is a arch, it's a door, it's an open door to opportunities for our investors and project sponsors.
Yeah, right. It makes sense. It makes sense. I do love it as well. Yeah, little known fact about myself, I wanted to become an architect back in the day. So much so, they told me to go to Sydney University, missed out by like 2 marks or 1 mark, and then they told me to go do a Bachelor of Design in Computing. But when I got there, some of the kids at Sydney University were so good. I just kind of looked myself in the mirror and went, it just isn't happening, and they rotated in finance. It's just interesting how everyone kind of makes their way in the world and ends up where they are. But the reason I wanted to have...
Pick it back up. You never know your hidden talent and, do something about it.
Absolutely. But the reason I wanted to have you on is, look, I'll phrase it this way. We've had some fantastic guests, a number of your competitors on, in both the funding space, the lending space on the credit side, for these types of projects, which we'll discuss today. And we've also had a number of developers on, or we work privately with a lot of, land sub, et cetera. But what I find really, really fascinating about what you do is you cover the entire life cycle of a development project. Not exactly common, right? And a bit of context of why I've been looking for this type of strategy for, a while, and why I find this interesting is, you mentioned 2019 when you kicked this off. I remember speaking with my friends and colleagues and investors saying that the single best investment now since the CBD was just hemorrhaging. The South African mob in Sydney went under on the construction side. All these construction companies in mass CBD locations were struggling. Meanwhile, there was this huge boom in warehouses being built for distribution hubs, off major ports and airports, for like Amazon. Everyone knows, everyone's seen, you can just click a button and all of a sudden a product's at your door, right? I've been wanting for a long time to, find a fund manager that has that capacity to go down the warehouse path, but also the land sub and the light industrial up in Queensland. But to my understanding, and, please, I'd love to hear the philosophy about how you invest and why you've chosen to fund the entire life cycle of a project. And also, how the catalyst or the thesis of why you specifically chose, these three or maybe more, distinct asset classes, within the property side. I'd love to learn more about your thought process and all that, Melissa.
That's a great question. I will start by touch on Labas's fundamental our investment thesis and investment philosophy. Now, Labas was funded initially was on the back of me as a busy banker looking for answers for myself and looking to invest in a safe asset class, don't risk too much, robust, that don't correlate and not volatile to small changes in market confidence or major global event. Something that I can go to bed knowing it's slowly accruing over time, and that can become the cookies in the jar for the stormy days. So I started investing in real estate not wanting to lose money, basically. That's why I don't choose other asset class, which is a bit more sensitive to macro environments. So I started investing, and then eventually this became a business, which I'm very proud of. So that leads to Labas's investment thesis is capital preservation is at the center of what we do. We as a team, real estate expert and finance investment experts, and we hone our muscles on a daily basis through going through numerous number of deals, and we say a lot of no's to pick up the right, the yeses. Now, we leverage on our experience on deal origination, structuring, negotiation, and risk management to protect investors' capital. We treat investors' capital more seriously than our own, which goes to our second pillar of our investment thesis, is that we invest with high conviction. We believe in asset classes. We're very attuned with the market, where the pricing is at, where the risk lies in the macro environment, how each pocket of this real estate market, the sub-markets and sub-asset classes behave, because real estate is a very localized business. one side of the highway could behave very different to another side of the highway in terms of liquidity volume. So we go deep on real estate fundamentals. At the same time, we co-invest with our investors based on our high conviction and also just to back our judgment on that investment decision for our investors. So we often place our capital as the first loss piece to back our judgments. And to date, we've never lost a dollar. And again, proudly speaking, the bus's entire duration to date of 5.5 years, we have not needed to put one asset to mortgage, through recovery process of mortgaging possession, selling someone out to recover investors' funds. So all investments that we've completed to date has come back through the planned normal exit channels, market sell or refi, completion of the project. So our investment thesis is capital preservation, co-investment for interest alignment, and we run an active portfolio management approach. And that is the overarching context. Now, then comes to Labasa being a full project lifecycle investor. Now, we call ourselves an investor than just a lender for this particular reason, because we do have equity and debt capability. In addition, we fund the full life cycle of the project. Now, putting ourselves in a project sponsor's shoes, the developer side for a minute. Now, if I were a developer, I come and I'm not going to the banks, I go to a non-bank. The rates is a bit higher. However, what am I getting then in return? Now, in private markets, currently it's certainly fast soaking up some of the voids that the bank has left. The banks are under their own pressures by the policymakers, not because they don't want to write deals, not because some of those deals are not bankable. People often ask, are the sponsors or the deal not bankable? So they come to private. Now that's a no. Not always. Of course, some of the deals are just not good quality, and we also say no to. However, there is a good batch of deals that are actually of good quality. The sponsors are rather go private for a few reasons. One is the private markets, the lenders are more flexible in terms of looking at, again, a project as an investment. However, banks were, given the volumes, probably looking at more through the grid sort of exercise. It's never black and white, of course. Banks are also coming up with innovative solutions these days. Private can just have a little bit more discretion because the investment committee decisions can be undertaken a lot more flexibly. Now, this doesn't mean that we don't go X degree to identify and quarantine risks to some extent, because we understand the space that we're playing by giving certain flexibilities, which does represent we're going a little bit higher on the risk scale in terms of the capital stack. Now, to compensate and to protect our position, we actually go very deep in terms of risk analysis. Our due diligence checklist has more than 60 items to go into it. People often say, they think, oh, private lending is pretty simple, right? Because one side, it does sound like a very simple business. And for some of our existing investors, before they fund us, they're already doing some sort of lending just through their solicitor funds, through their lawyers and accounting professionals assisting them to do some on and off deals before they fund us. But they can do it quite simply. However, in private lending, private credit, to do it well is not easy. Is one to be able to navigate through the trough, actually have a process that look at 60 items or more in an exit class from the outset looks simple, which at the same time, very closely monitor and run active portfolio management to be right in grooves of the market movements and the changes through the life cycle of the asset. If there is any early signs of risks, to be able to pick it up before it becomes a substantial risk, so that it, again, can help navigating through. Now, we look at a deal from an entire life cycle perspective, which simply is to say, when we look at a development project, we will be willing to fund the project from land acquisition stage to then allow it to further progress to through various condition precedents that it needs to meet to turn it into a construction project. For example, to complete the authority approval process, to achieve a level of pre-sales, to get to shovel ready, and then we would give them that land, transitional land facility to then get to the construction ready stage. At that stage, we would then top up to fund the entire construction on a cost to complete basis as a senior lender or stretch senior lender to complete the deal to full completion as an established asset. Now, along the way, some of the stock or majority of the stock may be sold. The developer may decide to keep a portion, maybe 20 lots or 30 apartments for their portfolio purposes, or, you know, just from tax reason or from try to capture the rising market perspective, they may want to delay the sales to earn a bit more on the final realizable value of the project. So we're happy to stay on to also fund the residual stock facility to provide the extra runway for the developer to sell it in either in an orderly manner or at the prime time. So by doing so, there is great advantage by approaching an asset this way. Now, we have seen some cases that didn't quite work well, work out from some of our peers. For example, they just don't touch construction at all, maybe because they don't feel comfortable or they're just not quite ready to take it on. Now, then if they only do land facilities, now just looking at as is direct comparison valuation for land facility for a project site, it's often not necessarily right because the as is comparison, comparing one site, development site to another based on most recent sales, are never in our experience so accurate because the apple is never exactly comparable to another apple in a real estate sense because of the proximity of the location, the characteristic of the site, what you can do with it, not exactly comparable. So if the fund only lent on a valuation basis on an as is and don't assess what's going to happen later with this development site, sometimes that value can be obscured. Now, if they lent on a 65% LVR, before they realize it, before they go into a recovery process, they identified, actually, if you look at it in a project sense, which is project-related site value, and that's putting the site, assess the land value in a feasibility sense, this LVR they've lent on is 110%. So that's when, even if the fund go out and recover the asset, they still lose money. Now, the advantages for us to look at entire life cycle is also from a risk management perspective. One side, we tick the box for developer, because when they come to us, they know, okay, if I speak to Labasa, I know they will be there for the entire time for me. And I just then, once that we often can even give in terms on land and construction. So at the land stage, we already completed due diligence. We do the forecast, we test the models, we check the major checkpoints on developer capability, experience, feasibility of the construction, numbers. Is there profit left for the project? Can this sponsor or can this project actually progress to construction stage? Is the product they're producing has a market take up for it? Are they priced appropriately? So we assess them independently based on the market data from multiple sources we see before we even receive a valuation. Valuation is the last point, just to check that our judgment is on par with what valuers think. So when we've gone this far for land loan even, it comes with a few folds. Developers love it because they know we're going to be there the whole way. We give them terms at land stage. We can give them land and construction terms so they know what their costs would be. So then all they need to do now is just focus on the delivery of the project. On the investment side, we have assessed this from end to end, how and what we're going to do with the site, whether this site, this idea, this architecture drawing can be turned into reality and still remain to be financially sound. And we also scope out the major risk pillars to make sure, okay, can this project go smoothly, sell into through the process of construction in this duration the project's planned for, the market cycle, and still achieve the price point that they're willing to achieve. And we also build, for every project we assess, we Labasa do our own feasibility as well. Developer do this, we do our own feasibility. We buffer up a lot, we flush through the buffers that's necessary for rainy days for developers. Sometimes, you know, obviously when our project sponsors are very proud of the project and it's their baby, and we appreciate that. And the optimism sometimes when it comes to us, and we act to be that level thinker, that other, you know, the more conservative, the gray hair partner to essentially put through the deal into very much more worse off case, just make sure the project's resilient so that all of us can come out in the end. So this, coming back to entire life cycle approach, brings us multiple advantages, and both from the project sponsor's point of view and ultimately Labasa act for our investors. And this is a risk management framework that we adopt, and also this approach make us known as an investor throughout the whole life cycle of a project. It expands our thinking and our outlook in terms of horizon. We look at this project from end-to-end perspective. In terms of asset class, you mentioned earlier on our sweet spot. So Labasa's current sweet spot in terms of the sub asset classes that we're funding, which is the majority of the book, is industrial, residential land subdivision, and boutique, tightly held, prestigious suburb, sub-6 level construction. Now, we're not heavily exposed into high rises at this stage, which was an active decision that was made by the house, by our investment committee, myself at the time, at the beginning, at the inception of COVID. We see this difficult time coming for the industry, which is unfortunate, and we have pivoted to simple forms of construction. It's never to say that we won't participate in high rises. We're actively looking at quite a few right now, and I think the shakeup in construction industry will further stabilize, in particularly beginning of next year. So we're already gearing ourselves up to start looking at some high quality projects in some great blue chip locations and to participate in high rises. But as it is now, the whole book is very healthy. We haven't gone on stock due to construction or builder go bankrupt or anything. We haven't got any of those cases in our hands. No, none of the project is stored. Everything's churning. So we're quite pleased with where we're at.
See, that's quite unique, and it's very interesting because, you know, you speak to someone about property that doesn't understand it, they do understand it, and never understands the risk. It's just such an interesting concept how you're investing and you're doing the full life cycle. Because my understanding with the risk side is if you cover one side and you specialize in it, that's fantastic. But what happens if the other part of the team doesn't hold up there in the bargain? Then essentially it doesn't matter what the deal is, or if you're making 50% or 100% or $1 billion. If you can't see it, the full life cycle all the way through, and one particular element, it collapses. That's where the risk is, right?
Surely.
Yeah, which is really interesting. So how, with from an investment perspective, with the fund, so my understanding is you're doing private deals as well, but you also have the fund. So just unpack the mechanics of the fund. What's it currently returning? What are the fees? What's the target return? What have you returned the past 12 months? What's the management fee? How's it structured?
Sure. Thanks for that. So Labasa offer our investors flexibility in terms of how they want to invest and what style of investing they're more attuned to. Everyone has a slight difference in their preferences, and we offer both a pool fund structure, which is more passive and set and forget. Manager would construct an accretive, a good, robust portfolio of asset in line with the objectives set out for the pooled fund. Our current pool fund invests in first mortgages, and it does allow a small portion of second mortgage, up to 30% of the portfolio. But as of end of June, currently it's 100% first mortgages across Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, primarily land subdivision assets. The fund's target return is 9%. We do give investors floating return, so we go out and negotiate very hard on behalf of investors to get the market return and also price risk for premium, and yet never go excessive risk for return. So we Labasa Private Credit Pool Fund objectives is to construct a portfolio which is most suited for some of our risk adverse and very conservative self-managed super fund investors, our old money. This particular pool fund bucket is designed to be a bucket where you can over time accumulate a healthy balance by reinvesting the returns into the fund. Also, whenever investors can do a gradual top up, whilst there a lot of them are business owners and very sophisticated investors themselves too. Whilst they're running some active investment strategies, whether it's in PE or active real estate, they still put aside some passive funds into the pool fund, knowing this vault is robust in terms of risk characteristics. If anything happened in the outside world to the active investment they're running in some higher risk strategies, they can come back to this little cookie jar and they can live on that. So our pool fund is designed to be a very defensive income-driven fund, which is a fund that will help our investors to build wealth over time with robust asset classes underneath, which is every dollar we invest in Labasa across the board. Of course, the pool fund is underpinned by real asset values. So the fund currently, whilst we target return is 9, manager charge is only 0.5% fixed manager fee. And investors gets the extra if the market is going up. We can negotiate harder to get extra returns. Investors gets the upside. So currently, as of end of June, the last financial year, the fund 12 months rolling performance net of fees is 11.09%. And on a fund from inception basis since 2019, which includes, earlier days, we've got a small amount of mezz in the fund. So fund's performance since inception is 12% plus, which is very high for how conservative the underpinning, risk is. Very proud of where this fund is at. Now, on the deal-by-deal level, we offer our larger investors, family offices, some of them they've got this much to allocate. They like to go directly into the deals and write a bigger check. So we do offer a deal-by-deal opportunities as well. We recently opened one that is a $15 million raise just last week, and we closed the raise in about 11 hours, over-raised $10 million. we have to trim everyone back. So it's a very humbling. Our investors have followed us, the investors that's known us and followed us for a long time. One thing we quite I'm personally quite proud of is that no one have left us because of the return or because of Labas's service or investment decisions. No investors has left us ever since early days. So that is something makes me very happy.
So with the credit funds, so just trying to get my mind straight on this, is the credit fund purely lending and then the equity piece is on a deal by deal basis? Is that how that works? Or is there an equity component in the fund?
No, very good question. So the pooled fund is debt only. So it's just a registered mortgage, given its conservative nature. Now, for a stretch senior position or senior, which is senior and mezz blended, or equity deals, now we structure it at the special purpose vehicle deal by deal level, which the pool fund may or may not participate, depending on whether we feel the risk profile is most suited for the pool fund. The pool fund is the very conservative bucket.
So wait, I'm just trying to get it. You have one fund, the credit fund. Is there a second fund for the pool fund, or is the credit fund also have the pooling component?
Okay, so the credit fund is open-ended pool fund, so it has multiple mortgages underneath. Now, alongside in parallel, we have got multiple deal-by-deal structures. Each structure is a unit trust on its own, closed-ended funds issued based on one deal only. Now, the pool fund can elect to take some positions in those assets as well to whatever capacity managers think deemed suit for the pool fund at the time. The pool fund may not participate at all on those single asset vehicle levels. So we've got a pooled fund, open-ended, with multiple assets underneath. Alongside with that, we have many deal-by-deal structures.
Now, that makes sense. The reason why I just wanted to distinguish this is someone's listening to this and going, okay, I'm allocating money as a wholesale investor into the wholesale fund. You know, I'm targeting... I like the credit component, but I also want the equity piece. They can get that exposure purely by the pool fund. They're not having to go, okay, I've got money in the credit piece to get access to the lend component, and then also having to do the direct component. That's a choice. That's what I just wanted to distinguish.
Yes, Nana, it's a very good question for clarity. So the pool fund at the moment is first mortgages only, and plus occasionally some small portion of second mortgages. Now, if investors, and often we do have investors been with us for senior for a long time to say, hey, I'm ready to go up the risk ladder, and at least I'm happy to reinvest my profit into equity deals. Can you put me in? So at this stage, we if they were to go debt and equity, we need to put them into the deal-by-deal SPV vehicles. So the equity deals are a separate SPV on its own. It's quarantined from the pool fund at the moment. Now, we are contemplating, and it's on the roadmap, that we will issue a pool fund number two in the second half of this year, which will be an equity fund.
Oh, excellent. So there's going to be a blend, higher leaning to the credit side with the current one you have, but then potentially towards the end of the year, you're going to be listing an equity-only piece. That's going to be interesting. I want to see that. Now to the fun part. Everyone wants to listen to what's the deals? How do you think about the deals? Why do you say no to a deal? But why don't we discuss, since you mentioned it before, you've just closed a $15 million transaction. I don't know if you want to discuss potentially what that deal is or how does it look like, if you can, or maybe another one. It'd be very interesting to hear it all play out with an actual deal.
No, thank you. Thank you. Doing deals is the thrilling part. And even from the banking days, I'm always at the front line, responsible for revenue, front office, make revenue making teams for the banks. So the thrill of closing a deal, you never get numb to it, bigger or small. So love doing deals, love closing deals, makes me happy. Now, this particular transaction is, again, it's actually speaks to what we mentioned earlier, is a entire life cycle play again. It's a 39 lot subdivision, residential house lot subdivision in the Northwest Sydney. It's a very robust location, fast growth, walking distance to the proposed shopping center, which is under construction. Now, we have backed the sponsor to purchase the land. At the time, it has a DA already, no pre-sale, no construction certificate. So we settled the land with them and provided the runway, the lead time to construction. And based on also the robust demand and demographic social economics, we've given this transaction a very flexible pre-sale terms. We allow the deal to start construction earlier without having to be held for too long, and then sell it as the civil works progress throughout the construction period. And we've got a midway progressive pre-sale hurdle, i.e. the facility is 15 months. We have by month nine, we'll have a pre-sale debt cover of 50%. This sort of covers and measures, make sure one, we allow the project to start earlier. We have done our assessment. This product will sell. So that's not a blanket, just a blind option to the sponsor. And we'll look at the data, look at the market. This product will sell. So they can start a bit earlier. And then, most recently, they've finished, everything's done. They've sold more than 60% of the lots, which, all the settlement has come through as of end of July. So now we're just tipping the rest of the stock into residual stock. So that's it's a perfect example for this whole life cycle approach, which for the developer is very easy for them, because they're throughout the whole duration of the project, they're talking to one team. And this one team has in-depth knowledge about this project from start to finish. So and often what we found is that there's no even a lot of incentives to even inquire for pricing elsewhere, because there's not even if the difference is a 0.5% here and there, it doesn't really move the needles for the developer coming to this point. So we love it too.
From the developer's perspective, do they have? What's their process? Do they have an option on the land or a letter of intent? And then essentially they required Labasa to come in and provide the capital to settle on the transaction? Or do they?
For this transaction, it's a straight sales contract. So they've entered into a purchase contract on the land, put the deposit down, and then start talking to financiers, which is Labasa at the time, on the land facility. And then we essentially say, okay, we'll come in for land and we'll fund the whole thing.
To make a deal like this worthwhile, instead of you just going and finding the deals yourself, my understanding is these transactions have to have like something unique, something interesting to get it there. From a returns perspective, what's the minimum return that you're looking for from an equity play, on this type of project? Is it 30, 40, 50%? Like what are the numbers?
Okay. So this particular case study is debt only. So we were the senior lender. And in a slightly stretched manner, so the LVR is still sub 70%. It's within the senior equation. Senior, we measure ourselves on an internal rate of return. It's a relative term. It's anywhere from single digit to early tens, which is where majority of the private houses are playing for senior at the moment, regardless. The banks is much lower. That's actually the spread between banks and private. Everyone is seeing that it's getting crunched when cash rate is high. The differential is not huge, but it still varies between that high single digit to early tens. based on the characteristic of the project and how high we go on LVR, how much risk we take is the variable. Now, on equity side, again, the variables is even wider, hence the return bracket is also wider, because equity capital comes into the project in the earlier phase of a development process. So in the risk sense, the earlier you come into the project, the more risks you are actually wearing throughout the project. The project de-risks as it goes, right? By obtaining all of the authority approvals, by obtaining some pre-sales, and by locking builders, the project de-risk as it goes. So we price our equity in a very dynamic manner, which is the right way to do so as well. We assess how much risk we're taking. Are we taking the full cycle of a project risk? Then we price ourselves as a true equity player, from, you know, more inclined to ordinary equity style of return. It is definitely, it starts from high teens to mid 20s, and that's sort of very wide range, and depending on how much risk we're taking. But if we're only coming in at a later stage when the project is largely de-risked, with the construction builder lined up ready to go, and obtained some pre-sales, proved the price point of the asset in the market, obtained all of the approvals shovel ready, when we come in the last mile, then we act more like a mezz sort of returns.
So that's for the land sub. Is the so just thinking about the three, which you do. So you do the land subdivisions, right? And then you got the light industrial. I find light industrial fascinating. Actually, I wouldn't mind getting into that, and specifically Southeast Queensland, where it's just booming. Why I find this so interesting is my family, my grandfather retired up in Noosa, you know, my uncle lives up there, and he always made a joke that, you know, everyone wants to live in Noosa. But what they don't understand is that you can't get a job in Noosa. You kind of have to bring a job or bring a business. Yes. And in COVID, what I found fascinating is when everything crashed and everything got destroyed, these, how would I best explain light industrial? You take a lot, 12,000 square meters, you put what, 20 to 23 lots of them. But what these are, to paint the picture, I don't know if you've ever driven around, like people listening, business hubs, and you see the, like a drive-in, and then you've got like a roller door either side, and then you've got like a walk-up. Why I love these assets is you can stick anything there. My business, I could go move to Noosa, Sunshine Coast, drop in, have a gym downstairs, you know, et cetera, park the car, park the boat. Meanwhile, I can run a full financial advisory business upstairs, or an accountant, you know, anything. You could go full fiberglass. My understanding is from a recession perspective, on the risk curve, this asset is very, very interesting because anyone can work there at any point in time. It's not, you know, purely just for the CBD. So, yeah, I'm just curious on
yes.
I don't know how to attack this, but maybe let's look at I don't know, for this particular sub asset class. You know, what suburbs, what regions is this the most attractive currently? And if you were looking at a deal, like what returns on the equity piece would you be looking for?
Sure. No, great little sub market topic to hash. Now, industrial is very hot, and we love this asset class. And ever since 2019, we have repetitively lent to industrial project, and we've backed a couple of industrial project sponsors across, you know, 6-7 different projects with the same sponsor until, you know, they're quite large players, and we see the fundamentals as the lender from our lens. We just love it, both from the debt and equity angle. Industrial asset is hot in Australia, driven by quite a few factors. One is that there aren't enough industrial or approved land use for industrial asset. At the same time, the society or the way people live and work demands more industrial assets to service them. Now, from a mom and dad individual's lifestyles perspective, there is the downsizing effect. People are moving to more prominent prime areas in a smaller living environment, maybe a beautiful owner-occupied apartment in the lower North Shore, but they might still have, you know, their vintage cars, their boats, and their toys, and there's nowhere to store in the apartment, which creates the self-storage service requirements for people getting used to higher density or downsizing living environment. On the business, that's factor one. And factor two, on the business side, there is this natural evolution of how business is delivered and conducted, how the services are rendered. These last few years, COVID accelerated it. As you mentioned earlier, people don't necessarily have to work in the city or live in the CBD of Sydney to benefit from the employment opportunity that Sydney offers. They can be living out of Noosa or run their business out of places in the outer areas by creating a space whereby you have your showroom, you have your storage display downstairs and have a mezzanine office upstairs, and you can create some very creative spaces and enjoy that headspace and the actual space to be more productive in that way. So the businesses on occupier style or rental for these sort of mid-sized spaces is also rising rapidly, driven by the way business and services are delivered these days. Now, thirdly, is from a servicing perspective, that servicing for both, again, the individual and businesses perspective, which requires more of regional satellite industrial parks to service people. One, from an individual's perspective, may choose to live outside of the CBD and save this travel time, but they might still be running a sizable business, whether it's cold storage or major, you know, trade businesses. They need larger warehouses. However, the existing warehouses, you know, service those regional those regions may have also be out of capacity. Hence, industrial park, the expansion or widening of this footprint of existing industrial park is on demand. Some of those are being created to cater for people who decide to leave and run the business out of the CBD, which is more convenient, more time efficient for them. On the other side, and because the city became more spreaded and population is growing, Australia is growing at a world-leading pace in advanced countries, since still at close to high 1% and 2% population growth. This is a very high number versus compared to other advanced countries. Some are shrinking, some are very sort of steady at the same pace. So Australia is still growing. While it's growing, which means the city is spreading further out of the CBD. It requires more larger facilities, which will cater for logistics centres to go and reach out to provide goods and deliveries to those satellite cities to service a broader radium in the sense that people live and work. So larger companies is also securing bigger facilities in broader region to, one, optimize their efficiency from a logistic and distribution perspective to service broader area to create centers. On the other side, businesses also needed to expand because natural demand is expanding too. So industrial, in a nutshell, is very hot. Now, Labasa is looking, we love this asset class, so we are going equity and debt in this asset class. On one side, it's simpler than high rises. We love it too, and it's larger land content footprint. We've recently secured a project whereby one of Labasa's special purpose vehicle fund will acquire the land and work the asset, and then establish warehouse sheds and hold on behalf of our investors for long-term income and capital appreciation.
Yeah, it's a fascinating asset class, and I think I was speaking to a colleague, I can't remember if it was Chemist Warehouse or another one of the major players, but something about the distribution hubs with these large, you touched on the distribution hubs like Amazon, all these drop shippers, or you can just be a one person shop and have a huge warehouse space, you know, for these drop shipping style businesses. But from a risk management, which also benefits the demand side with COVID or, you know, getting the flu, these days, if one warehouse gets the flu, they kind of send everyone home and it goes to a standstill. But what I'm hearing from large businesses, they're seeing that risk in the past couple of years going, oh dear. And then they're just naturally going to go, they're going buying different hubs just in case. If one shuts down, you've got another two to go. So essentially the flow doesn't stop. So people can get their products, you know, in a timely fashion and it doesn't disrupt the cash flow process. Are you seeing that strategy is becoming quite common now, or is that just a knee-jerk reaction to you know, past events that's slowing down?
Oh, it's certainly the trend. Even from the office space, where people are seeing the headquarters trim back on leasing footprint and create again the region-centered sub-hubs for employees to go and work in the neighborhood. Now, industrial side, it's case by case and depending on the business's efficiencies, mostly for larger tenants, that they would evaluate the whole network footprint of the country, for example, in the strategic planning time, potentially look at, okay, if we take up a footprint in this particular strategic location, which will feed to the next one in terms of exchange and stopover, and then go to the next stopover to service the other region. So they may shuffle their distribution centers and reorganize it in a more effective way to get either consolidation or actually split from whichever sense that makes more economic sense to deliver services. You know, for example, for distributions, logistics centers, we're seeing more split at the moment because the last mile logistics has become very hot because the businesses that is doing the B2C delivery wanted to be same day delivery. Right. Before it's 2 weeks, it's no longer competitive. And it's in Asia countries, it's 2 hours delivery when you buy online.
Did you say in Asian countries like China, it's two hours delivery?
And it's actually put on the website when you purchase. For example,
the logistics on that would be crazy, exactly. The number of trucks.
So these are the new behaviors and consumers' trends. And then to also beat your competition. So this then creates more last mile, the sub-distribution centers. So the major warehouses will distribute to these sub-logistic centers that is actually within 30 minutes drive to where most people live. So that's the example of the spread. And then from a cost efficiency, they might close down a couple, the businesses might close down a couple, satellite distribution center might build a bigger new facility for storage cost efficiencies because they've now got this other sub-centers that is right in the heart of the city. So driven by business demands, it could vary a bit, but these are some of the trends we see, which lines up with this more fast-paced, competitive consumer consumption side.
If I'm understanding you correctly, because how I was thinking of it is just every single major port, you know, you stick in a massive distribution hub, and then I was thinking, okay, you get one for, you know, each major state and then off it goes. But what you're saying is they're going distribution hub for the state, for the main port, or even Newcastle or something specific. But then they're also putting in a smaller one on a regional scale, just essentially across the entire footprint. So theoretically, every single major, you know, consumption from a consumer standpoint that actually is a big consumer, they'll potentially put in a distribution hub just to service that municipality. Is that what I'm hearing? So that means the demand is just going to keep climbing in this space.
Yep. The
the it's not slowing down. Like I thought potentially, like, okay, once everyone's got COVID, it just stops. Mm. But it's never going to stop, because the more population grows, you need to find places to live. People are farmlands just being bought up for, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. They're doing 600 houses. You know, it's just growing and growing and growing, which means every single place for every single major company will require some form of satellite distribution house there. So this space, if I'm understanding it correctly, isn't really slowing down. It's just naturally going to evolve like a beautiful virus.
There is a growing demand. So one is from fulfillment centers for fast delivery, we touched on. The other side is business owners may decide to exit from a shopping center, because business these days not entirely dependent on this pedestrian traffic anymore. So it's online competition. It's the selling to the internet based customers. So they may decide to retreat themselves and exit from a shopping center, paying high rent and limited space, and don't have space for lesser organized items to be not put on display. And then they might decide to, okay, I don't want to go far. I'm leaving my cart in a city, and I want to have a warehouse just in the inner city, and I'll run it from there. So that is also another stream.
I love it. Now, there's probably a lot of developers going to listen to this, and they're probably thinking to themselves, if I was going to speak to Labasa, what is their wish list? You know, suburbs? So let's say, you know, Queensland to begin with. Like, what suburbs do you think right now possess the hottest opportunity? Like, what's the most attractive, fast-growing suburbs, like, you know, in Queensland? If, like, you know, someone's looking at a project and, you know, you had your pick of the litter, like, what would flag your interest?
This is a million-dollar question.
This is the fun part.
Well, we'll share it over a glass of red wine. However, broadly speaking, because we do, as Labasa's investment house, we're location agnostic and essentially asset class agnostic. We do look deeply into every deal's fundamental. There's one great advantage as well, as we say agnostic, because Labasa only invest in real asset class, we don't touch anything else. We are able to aim for a broader footprint in terms of location of the asset and asset types. So we do hold a very good amount of knowledge base in each vertical. So from the hot pocket and where we trade most, we still end up noticing that we trade most in Eastern Seaboard. So currently all of our assets are in Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. We also transacted in Adelaide. We're keenly looking to Perth and other locations. We're agnostic. We can go metro, we can go regional, which we have done. Again, we assess every deal on its merit, and we price each deal based on the risk profile and time span in that sense. So we do approach every deal not in a quickie cutter way. In terms of the sweet spot, we love to continue to growing our footprint on in terms of investment appetite is again still the land subdivision space, the industrial subdivision and build form. We love them. And also the boutique build, beautiful quality, medium high finish residential apartments in that 25 to 150 key sort of scale, which I think it's a good size for the efficiencies, to also from a risk management perspective. If something goes wrong, we can still, you know, work it out together, and it's a good size that we can sort of solve problems on. So I'll leave it as that.
We'll have a glass of wine to figure out where the hotspots are, but that makes a lot of sense. You know, that's very, very interesting. Is there another a deal example that, you know, you've done recently that you want to dig into, or is there any other areas you want to discuss that's on your mind?
I'll mention a quick one. So everyone knows that the COVID period hasn't been easy for any new builds, and certainly it's not to say Labas hasn't experienced a project not going as planned. Now, we're always going into a project, one, we assess very tight. We want to choose a successful project rather than a project that is going down and only financiers make the money. It's just not our style of investing. We assess and select the right deals to go in, whereby everyone is going to take their share, and we're going to come out successfully. So we do go into project with a conservative assessment, but still choose a successful, robust, resilient project to go into. However, when something happened, like the broader environment, as a disruption, as the scale of COVID, we had a project where, and it's a new build, it's an apartment, and certainly experienced cost overruns because of the labor cost, time delays, and the construction materials. It compounded to quite a sizable cost overrun, which we're talking about in construction cost of price rise during COVID was 30% plus. But again, it's one that we were very comfortable. We always, when something happened, we're project not going as planned. Our approach, because we run an active portfolio management approach, we're in touch on a weekly, biweekly, monthly, if not more frequent, every other day basis. When something when environment is tightening, project's experiencing some issue, we jump onto the forefront of it, and we appreciate often when something happens, our sponsors communicate with us openly and proactively, just so that the problems aren't vested and until it gets to an explosive stage. And we also have our checks and our monitoring scheme. So often we identify issues and prevent issues from occurring in an early stage. For example, we're looking details on whether a major order has been made. Now, if within a certain period, in the context of the project program, now if a major order hasn't been made by a certain time, we just know this project is going to experience a delay. So we surface that in advance. And if it's oversight or if there's a reason it's not made yet, we have a conversation with our sponsors, make sure we keep keep them in check, nothing's missed, and we work as a team with them. When cost overrun happens during COVID, and we assess again, is this the stock that the market will still be willing to take? And it was yes, it's in the lower north shore, it's a very tightly held market. And is this a risk that is materially escalating the credit risk profile? Not to a degree, yes, because there's cost overruns. But however, if we go a bit longer and then given time and extra capital to bankroll the project, is this a better outcome for investors? It's yes, because the worst case is to sell a project halfway before the end realizable value for a construction project is actually crystallized. If a funder is backing off midway, it's a disaster. So we've got our frameworks. We make sure our credit risk escalation is still within our threshold, and investors getting paid for taking that extra risk, and the risk is still within threshold matter. So that because every go up, every letter, every mark of the risk threshold requires Labas to take a different approach in terms of managing our risk profile, and we're very acute with that. And for me and the team, we respond to things quickly, and we work around the clock to solve problems, and we're proud of that. So this particular project went through the difficult period, and we stuck in there the whole time. We backed the sponsors, we backed our judgment, we backed the project. At the end, the project's fully completed end of last year. A few sweet factors was we also allowed, because at the initial DD stage, this type of product is certainly going to, it's very short of supply. It's extremely short of supply in Sydney, North Shore. So we allowed the project to go with lower pre-sale threshold to allow them to sell better for a better price when people can see the finishes. And typically that's how this more luxury product end up. So the project has overachieved, even though there has been cost overruns. In terms of the end sales value, one of the unit has picked up extra 40% in price, and that largely compensated to this also extra ground on costs as well. And again, because we had we've taken a view to allow that flexibility there. It saved the day. If we, let's just say, if they have to go to the banks or, you know, more strict, on a more strict terms, which requires selling majority of the stock at the beginning of COVID, plus the cost of run, they will absolutely be upside down. So it was a good case. Again, this particular case, we gone in land settlement, we've done a stretch senior, and we banked the project through construction. We're now on a residual stock tranche with them, so it's a full life cycle again.
Now that's really interesting, and that's from the beginning of our conversation, what I find very interesting about this, the entire life cycle of a project strategy is, and look, anyone that invests or looking at assets, as we know, timing, you can't control it to an extent, and if something goes badly, it's how do you respond in that particular environment, which will determine, you know, potentially how the result is. And it's nice to hear that you're not forced into making, like some companies, or, you know, as you mentioned, the banks, they force you into essentially cutting your losses, getting out immediately to essentially stop the bloodshed. That might help in the short term, but the long-term ramifications of that can be huge when essentially if you have a full life cycle partner that understands there are risks, and it's not the decision about just getting rid of it and stop the bloodshed. It's okay, what options do we have? How can we resolve this and still get a good outcome, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, and if I'm understanding it correctly, being commercial,
yeah, the problem solving, which is what you do, right? You essentially help a partner problem solve it.
Yeah, and also we ultimately act, you know, with the framework. So we also, you know, we manage threshold matters, but we make sound commercial decisions. And something goes wrong, one thing that our investors will have and our project partners will have out of La Basa is, if something goes wrong, one phone call comes to us, the whole team, we will be on the clock, 20 coffees a day until this done, this thing's done.
How many in the team? I forgot to ask, because, you know, you can't be everywhere. So how many is in the La Basa team now?
We're nine of us. We're still with boutique, where everyone is very cross-trained and multitasked. Six of us are full-time, three of us are senior advisors. You know, we're quite sufficient in the way we are. Everyone multitask.
Yeah, right. The other thing which I found is what I love about, you know, having these conversations. So we don't know who's listening. There could be like a 16-year-old kid going, I want to get into property because my dad's in it, my grandfather's in it. And, you know, is there any advice or counsel you would have to a young mind, you know, looking at the path of, you know, getting into this particular investment space?
Become a real estate investment manager?
Oh, yeah, anything. Like going down the yeah, getting into the world of the property side, the lending side, the equity, looking at deals. Is there any, you know, and it's not just a young mind being 16. What I've found, and you've probably found the same, some of the brightest people I've ever found in particular spaces are doing something else. They might be 27, 30 years old, listening to this going, what am I doing with my life? But I've been running projects, I don't know, in liquor or a booze company or an accountant, and they just want to change. Is there any thoughts you have to, you know, sure, anyone looking to get into this space?
Yeah, no, good question. Good question. And these are, again, the major million-dollar questions for anyone to think about, whether it's establishing a footprint into a brand new area, coming into your career, or as a career change. I think before diving into the specifics of the industry and whether it's a, you know, of course, one, you choose a rising industry, so the industry that's still growing versus, for example, this coal-powered power station. You probably guess it's a demising industry, and if it's an industry that's fast-growing, that's good. However, that's definitely not everything. You need to break it down to, okay, within this, I want to, first of all, sail in the direction of the wind. Tick. Because it just means there's more opportunity. Doesn't mean if you go reverse, there isn't. Life is never black or white. Just remember that. So, and tick, a growing industry just potentially implies there's more opportunity. Then, however, it's most important to look into, okay, what specifically there's multiple streams within this industry. Also, on real estate online, you can choose to be an investment manager, you can be a developer, or a valuer, and there's many different streams. And before you go into that, because real estate is the key word, so I think anyone thinking of going to real estate side needs to have a passion for real estate. You need to love looking at properties, and you feel energized when you're talking about a property deal, and that's the part about finding your passion. So if it lights you up when you talk about property, which I do, you're probably in the right direction as well. And then if you found the industry and the property as those two boxes tick, and then again it's around your natural strengths. What's your natural strength? Are you more on the deal side or on an analytical side? There's various different type of roles which guards the door of an organization in a particular stream niche, like Labasa is investment management house. We also have our front office, our middle office, which is the compliance, risks, strategy, reporting, and then the deal making side. You know, what is more suited for the individual. You want to run and be the chief negotiator, or you want to be, you know, this very analytical mind and to make sure everything's in order because you're just naturally super organized. I think these are not different to when people decide to make a horizontal or going deep into one area. It's coming down to a few points. One is to do what you love, which is, I'll end this with my definition for happiness. I do openly share with the team, and some of my customers hear this too, and it is how I run my life, right? So my definition of happiness when I left the banking world, this is what has driven me to establish Labasa, is do what you love based on what you're naturally good at. So choose an area you're passionate about, and do it the way you want. So, you know, how you want to, what type of firms aligns with your values, what sort of cultures that they have, or do you want to go and go solo? And if you go solo, you enjoy the flexibility, or you actually want to go together with others and go further, right? That's another choice as well. And then last point is crucial, is do it with people you love. And for Labasa, I choose very carefully who comes into the firm. And we sometimes, you know, we unfortunately have to do some selections, reselections. And it's very important who we share our lives with. It enrich the journey. You know, the financial outcomes will come when you tick those three things. We don't even need to think about it. We will create successes for our customers. We will create success for self, which is self-development, exceed our version today, tomorrow. Right, so build self in a spiritual and capacity holistic manner. We talk about this a lot within the firm. So I think going along, do what you love, do it the way you want, do with people you love. If you go with those three principles, whether it's real estate or something else, you're on the right track.
Well said. Couldn't agree more. If anyone wants to learn more about Labasa, how can they reach you?
Our website is labasa.com. We also update some of our insights both on the website and on LinkedIn corporate profile. We just started a Facebook profile as well, which is something new. So on our website, interested Parties can also subscribe to our newsletters, and we do share insights regularly, given we're seeing such a large volume of deals, and we do have some good understanding of how things are moving. So I would encourage everyone to check us out.
Fantastic. All right, Melissa, it's been really insightful having you on, and that conversation was a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to picking up it again soon.
I certainly enjoyed our conversations. Thank you again for having me here.
All right, Melissa, have a great day.
You too. Bye for now.
Any views expressed in this recording do not represent the view of any other third party and are the sole personal opinions of the speaker. Any reference to financial product does not constitute advice or recommendation, and before any action, you should seek proper advice from your financial professional. Australian listeners should head to www.moneysmart.gov.au to find more information on obtaining financial advice. To get in touch with York, head to our website www.yorkwealth.com.au.